Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA Design and Architecture. It's awards season in Hollywood, and it is very unlikely that you would find a category where no one wins a prize. But that's what happened for a major architecture award.
We just didn't feel comfortable with elevating any of the submissions this year. And I don't think anybody on the jury or any group on the jury had an aversion to any ism, whether it was modernism, postmodernism, or anything.
First up, though, a tech company is going to build the new company towns. 20 cities across North America are celebrating because they have been shortlisted to be Amazon's HQ2. Los Angeles is one of them. But here's the big question facing LA. How would it house Amazon's anticipated 50,000 employees? Like fellow contenders Boston, New York, and Miami, LA's housing is very expensive and there's resistance to building more. Richard Florida is an urban theorist whose latest book is The New Urban Crisis. He says cities trying to woo Amazon should consider this.
These companies like Amazon pay their creative class and tech workers like gold, give them cafeterias, give them on-site healthcare, give them on-site daycare, give them on-site dog parks, and they treat their service workers like dirt. They contract that work out. They treat these people terribly. They're subject to precarious conditions. They're commuting an hour or two to work. I just wrote a piece arguing to Amazon and Google and other tech companies that are investing in cities, but also to great universities and hospitals, real estate developers, and all these corporations that consider themselves anchor institutions, that it is their economic and moral obligation to stop extracting from cities, seeing them just as a talent pool or a place to host workers or place companies, and to see them as a place to really build inclusive prosperity. And I enumerate that those corporations should be partners in the provision of affordable and workforce housing. They should be not creating private buses and private commutation systems for their workers or private parks for their workers to enjoy or private healthcare centers or gymnasiums or cafeterias. They should be establishing public goods.
That was Richard Florida. Tech companies, it seems, are recognizing that they have to look beyond the bounds of their campuses. Facebook has announced plans to build a village of 1,500 homes and a walkable retail district in the Bell Haven section of Menlo Park. That is one of the last affordable places to live in Silicon Valley. Facebook's facilities director, John Ternanes, outlined their plan in this company video.
What is important to Facebook is the fact that the campus needs to be integrated into the community. And I think what you'll see is a series of connections, bridges, crosswalks that bring our campus, our village into Bell Haven.
Facebook's Menlo Park campus, by the way, is designed by LA's Frank Gehry, and the company has tapped Rem Koolhaas's firm OMA to design the residential village. But what's described here has echoes of an industrial-era company town, and that's the view of Zach Mortis. He wrote about what Facebook can learn from company towns for the Atlantic City Lab.
If you watch the videos they've produced, it's all couched in a very progressive set of urbanist values. 15% of these residences are going to be offered below market rate. They're doing some transit planning. They're talking about how they can deal with urban density to deal with congestion. And so they're really hitting it on the head that their goals for this, you know, quasi-new 21st century company town are to make a really broad-based, holistic community that can plug into the existing urban fabric in Silicon Valley near Menlo Park and offer something back to it other than offices and, you know, dormitories to go sleep while you're not at the office working for Facebook. And that harkens back to really some of the most successful company towns from the 19th and early 20th century, the way they did business in some ways.
Are you saying that Facebook would essentially become the landlord? Would they own homes? Would they own retail outlets?
So we don't really know a whole lot of details about exactly how the real estate transactions would be, We don't know if they would own it outright, if they would lease spaces or rent them. But it absolutely is a new frontier for Facebook, for other tech companies. Google is thinking about doing certain things. And, of course, there are these, you know, monster bids by just about every city, recently narrowed down to a short list of 20, to get that second Amazon headquarters.
So here you are finding companies in Silicon Valley whose trade is digital, and yet going back to the future in a way to look for a solution to this problem of providing housing, creating community. And you've written about this model of the company town, and one that works and one that worked less well in the long run.
So a company town traditionally could have been a place where the company owned and ran the school your kids went to. They owned and ran the transit networks, the streetcars, the trolleys. They owned and ran all of the businesses that sold you their goods. In some situations, you may not have even been paid in American legal tender. They may have offered you something called scrip, which is basically like money that you can use at the company store. And, you know, there were thousands of these across the country. This happened in all over the country, really, especially like New England textile mills is where it started, all the way down through Appalachian mining towns. And really what you see is a really wide diversity of company towns were kind of operated by benevolent capitalists looking to make really long-term investments, and on kind of on the other end, the dystopic end, vultures really looking to use this urban infrastructure to extract all the money and value they could out of the land and out of the people. So I think urbanists and city lovers and citizens of all stripes, I think, need to take a step back and think about, you know, what is the role and the necessity for pure publicly owned space. I don't see any forces out there stopping someone like Amazon from doing exactly what they want to do in the years ahead. We're at the tail end of many years of corporate consolidation. You can buy literally anything from Amazon, including maybe in the future your own apartment.
That was Zach Mortis talking about Silicon Valley's take on the traditional company town. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. So there is one place that was once a company town of sorts, and that is Santa Monica. Around the middle of the last century, many of Santa Monica's citizens held blue-collar jobs at Douglas Aircraft, at what is now Santa Monica Airport, and they lived in houses built for them around the site. That neighbourhood is now affluent Sunset Park, and regular workforce housing is almost impossible to come by. It is estimated that four-fifths of people who work in Santa Monica do not live there. And their commutes are so awful, the city has a whole department devoted to figuring out how to improve it.
Mobility Division, this is Jack.
Jack Moreau manages transportation for the city of Santa Monica. He calls local companies and finds out how their employees get to and from work. And he helps figure out how to improve their journey and, where possible, how to get them onto alternative transit and help keep the air clean.
It's like every day is a new game, you could say. And every day you wake up and the roads are empty and we have this endless supply of freeway. And every day that resource gets eaten up. Now, we can use different kinds of incentives, encouragement, and education to guide people and, you know, play the game again. And hopefully one day we win and there's no more traffic. But the playing field right now is stacked up in favor of driving. And that's because of all of the investment that's happened to make it so easy, convenient, comfortable, and cheap.
Now, the main impetus for this outreach is to lower the city's carbon footprint and mitigate traffic. But one of the ways to cut traffic might simply be to have more people live closer to work. Anthony Orlando is working on a PhD on housing and financial policies at USC.
when we bring in jobs, we should be building the housing near it. When the aerospace companies came in the early 20th century, and they built up along the west side, and they were churning out, you know, big airplanes and big factories, and they created middle-class jobs, a lot of them were like little company towns. They built the housing right there near the factories so that people didn't have far to commute. Those middle-class jobs were one of the biggest political motivations to help get over that hurdle to encourage communities to allow building, to get city councils to approve it, because they saw the connection. Once those jobs went away, it's been a lot harder to get the housing built because they don't have the companies pushing for the middle-class housing for those middle-class jobs.
One group of commuters finds this traffic game so draining they're starting to quit their Santa Monica jobs, and that is teachers. So the Santa Monica Malibu School District may get into the construction of housing. Let's hear first from Dr. Hilary Weissman. She's assistant principal at Malibu High School, and she lives in Long Beach.
I generally wake up at around 4 o'clock, and I am out the door by 5. If I leave school anywhere between 4 and 6, I'm looking at near, you know, 2.5 hour to 3 hour commute home.
How do your family and friends feel about you doing this lengthy commute?
My parents are not that thrilled for me to be on the road that long, just because it's very late sometimes at night and it's a long day, so you get tired, and the traffic has a sense to either get you angry or sometimes it just kind of wants to lull you to sleep. So I probably talk to my mom for maybe an hour, hour and a half, and debrief my day with her so that I stay awake, and it just kind of helps the drive and preserve my sanity a bit.
Greg DeLeo is the head of physical education at Lincoln Middle School. He lives in Ventura.
Well, I'll leave the house at about 6:30, and typically it's about an hour and a half down, typically. I get a lot of books on tape handled, some very long books on tape. I've done War and Peace, the Iliad and the Odyssey, most of Dickens, so...
People make the joke, I could have read War and Peace, and you literally did.
I listened to War and Peace. I couldn't read it.
Did you like the novel?
It went on a little bit too long, but it was good, yeah.
Well, I guess you could call this an upside to commuting. But still, it's not the ideal way to keep teachers happy. Carrie Upton is COO of the school district.
One of our challenges is that we are having a hard time both getting people to work for us and retaining them, because after a while, the commute sort of wears down on people. We've begun considering how we might actually help support our teachers, our staff members, by providing housing closer, someplace in Santa Monica. This would be workplace housing, so it's not that we would be providing free housing, but we would help provide them something that they could afford within the budgets and the salaries that we are able to pay.
And would this be housing that would be built by the district on land owned by the district?
We know that there are a couple of different options, whether it would be built by the district or it would be working on a piece of land, working with a developer to sort of share that. We haven't quite figured that out. This is also an issue in the San Francisco, Silicon Valley area. There's a number of different models that have been being looked at, and we're watching closely what they're doing to see if they can find any success in this.
But even if the school district were to build housing for its workers, it is unlikely they'd be generous-sized homes with yards that Angelenos typically desire. But it can still be well-designed. Just consider an example built in Newark, New Jersey, by the architect Richard Meyer, designer of the Getty Museum. It's called Teacher's Village, and it was backed by Nick Berggruen. He is the financier and philanthropist who currently plans to build his Berggruen Institute on the west side.
We built Teacher's Village in the middle of downtown Newark, and we brought not only teachers there, but also there are four schools there. So, and now some shops. So we revitalized a very difficult area, and we did it with a very good architect, Richard Meyer, as opposed to compromising on beauty. We think beauty and aesthetics should be for everyone, not just, you know, for some. Could it work in Los Angeles? No question.
That's Nick Bergruen. So if the school district did build housing for its teachers, what would Hilary Weissman at Malibu High think?
I would love that. It would make me rethink buying a cot and putting it underneath my desk here. I think that would be, you know, that's outstanding.
I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up after this break, we'll hear why the AIA chose not to give out an important architecture prize.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. It's awards season, and not just in Hollywood. Every year, around this time, the American Institute of Architects bestows honours on buildings by fellow professionals. One of 9 National Design Awards went to an LA building. More on that in a moment. But the jurors caused a bit of a stir this year by choosing not to give any building or firm its 25-year award. This is a prize that goes to a building that has, quote, stood the test of time and continues to set standards of excellence for its architectural design and significance. Past winners include Louis Kahn's Salk Institute in La Jolla. So what was so bad about buildings from 25 to 35 years ago?
We just didn't feel comfortable with elevating any of the submissions this year.
This is Lee Becker of DC-based firm Hartman Cox. He was the jury chair, and he emphasized to us that their range of choices is limited to the submissions they receive from the design firms. However, their decision still has critics asking if it was because their time frame coincides with postmodernism, which many architects loathe.
No, there wasn't that. I mean, you know, the juries always have a cross-section of attitudes, but not that decidedly far apart. And I don't think that anybody on the jury or any group on the jury had an aversion to any ism, whether it was modernism, postmodernism, or anything. That just wasn't it.
That's interesting, because postmodernism is making a comeback now. So it is an interesting moment, because there is a generation that's going, oh my God, no, please, let's not revisit postmodernism. There's a new generation that's saying we love it. And you had even Curbed, you know, the online publication, writing, you know, why didn't the award panel make a statement about the threats to postmodernism by choosing Philip Johnson and John Burgee's AT&T building where demolition started on the lobby recently, or Michael Graves' Humana building from 1985 in Louisville?
As a juror on a jury like this, one tries to be objective and understand when it comes from, what the era is, what the people were trying to achieve, and then whether it is of noteworthy significance. There will always be folks with their own agenda. I didn't feel that here, that wasn't the reason.
Now, let's now go to your annual National Design Awards. And this year, I think you selected 9 buildings for that prize, and one of them is here in Los Angeles. It's the new federal courthouse designed by the Los Angeles branch of SOM. Tell us why that building made your cut for a National Design Award.
I think what perhaps grabbed everybody the most was the quality of light in the building. Federal courthouses are extremely difficult buildings to do because you have, one, many players, and two, the security requirements are such that oftentimes the courtrooms wind up in the middle of the buildings and don't have good light. SOM did an amazing job at having light filter down through the building. The building fits its context extremely well, has a really sophisticated facade, and it was just an all-around solid building, and we felt that it should be given an award.
And when you make these choices, do you visit the buildings, or do you make sure at least one person on the jury has visited the building and kind of can attest to the qualities that you see in the photographs?
Right. That's part of the process. So you basically go through almost a shortlisting process where you filter down the awards and everybody says, okay, these are noteworthy. These need visitation. Every project that was selected got visitation or interviews. Actually, they all got visitation except the one in Afghanistan because we were afraid to do that. But I spent a lengthy interview with the folks who were involved in that building there.
I'm calling you from Los Angeles. Award season is hot here, but it's mainly for Hollywood. And there's a lot of pressure that is exerted by the various different teams associated with the different movies to kind of get their movie out there. So they don't just submit plus marketing. Does that happen within the Architecture Awards?
No. Actually, it's totally anonymous. Unless we have seen something published, which is only by happenstance, we generally don't know who the architects are. And even when we visit, we try to keep the purpose of our visit under wraps.
So you're like a restaurant critic?
Yes. clandestine, I suppose. But we really don't know who the architects are.
Huh. Unless that architect has a recognizable style, which is true of some firms and not others.
Right. So, sometimes you can see it and know that, yeah, I sort of know who this is. But that's not the common sort of thing.
Lee Becker was chair of the jury for the AIA's 2018 Design Awards. The new federal courthouse that won a national design award is in downtown Los Angeles, on the south of First at Broadway. And if you participated in the Women's March last year or this year, you may have passed by it in the crowd. It was the backdrop in a widely published picture from last year's march, and it is a 10-story cube clad in a kind of pleated glass that appears to hover over a public plaza. The pleated glass is configured in a way that reduces energy use substantially. It was designed for the General Services Administration by the Los Angeles office of the firm Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, or SOM. SOM has designed some of the world's most famous towers, the Willis Tower in Chicago, the Freedom Tower in New York, and Burj Khalifa in Dubai. Here in LA are two of the courthouse's designers, Michael Mann and then Jose Palacios.
I think as architects, you know, we love problems. I mean, we're problem solvers. You know, we love great puzzles, and courthouses are Rubik's cubes to solve. And in terms of just all the complications of them, I mean, they have different levels of circulation and privacy and security, and all those things have to be woven together. When we did the original competition for the building, it really came from an inside out, you know, thinking about the building in terms of how the floor plan lays out, how courtrooms are arranged on a typical floor. And so whenever we figured out what was the best way to do that and then started stacking it vertically, we all of a sudden realized we had this sort of perfect cube. And then the idea of, you know, how does a cube sit on this kind of a slope site in the Civic Center, you know, became sort of the next issue for us. And so it became pretty clear that it really just shouldn't plop onto the ground, that we should really elevate this thing, lift it up, and allow people to come and enter under the cube as opposed to through the face of the cube.
And then the skin is both a bit metaphorical and also a response to the environment. The metaphor comes from the idea of the building wanting to be forward-looking, light and transparent, not unlike what the justice system is, very transparent. And light, but it sits on a very solid foundation, which is the Constitution. Therefore, you see limestone and glass. Because courthouses are not necessarily very transparent buildings because of the function, and there's a lot of dark spaces that don't require daylight, but there's also others that they do, mainly the public spaces. The facade is designed to respond to the environment and also to harvest as much light into those spaces as possible.
One of the other pieces that really struck us as we started to work on this project was its location, sort of on the cusp of the Civic Center and the CBD office buildings. And so, you know, trying to create a building that was not to be confused that it was an office building, that it would really belong to the Civic Center was really important to us. And, you know, really creating this plaza space, which could be a real civic gesture. I don't know if any of you were here for the Women's March. That was pretty amazing. See some photographs here. We were down here for that. And to see how the public took this space out in front of the building here was really, we were so excited to see how this building became a part of the city that day.
Now, possibly the most astounding aspect of the building that you experience once you clear security at its entrance is a soaring atrium space. It's an extremely peaceful, calming space with light washing down from skylights above. And this was intentional, say the designers, because the business of the court is so often not calming. Back to Jose Palacios.
Those tensions are there, you know, bringing light, the addition of the courtyard, bringing those places of respite and ability to kind of get away for a moment and light into the public space so that when you go there, you are a bit enlightened by the space despite the stresses of the business of the courts.
This atrium has very little furniture or decoration, so your eye is drawn to an artwork, a series of photographs of Yosemite Falls that cascades down several floors of the building. And this was created by none other than photographer Catherine Opie, who you may have heard on last week's DNA, talking about her movie The Modernist, in which a frustrated artist torches her favourite modernist houses. Back to Catherine Opie.
The courthouse is an amazing building, and it's actually quite a utopic building compared to the older courthouse. If you look at them side by side, it's almost not the same. And I know that the judges were having like difficulty leaving their kind of chambers to go to this newer building. But the piece is really deals with the iconography of California, and one of the obviously most famous landscape sites of California is Yosemite Falls. It is fragmented, which I'm really interested in the fragmentation of landscape. I've done it in numerous pieces because it also relates to time, too. When you fragment something, it's almost like stopping a watch. And it hovers down six floors. But it also relates to the scales of justice in my mind. So that all of a sudden, in the middle of the piece, you are in this dark, murky forest in the same way that if you have to go before a federal judge, your life might be in that same place. And so the building also has these really fantastic walkways throughout it that jog at different aspects. And so the other thing is these walkways act as vantage points to the photographs and the falls. And you can never see the totality of the piece. And that's the exact same way that if you hike Yosemite, you never see the totality of the falls. You all of a sudden wrap around a corner and you have a different perspective.
So clever. I will say that the day we went to tour, we only got to see the calm, peaceful face of the inside of the building. We didn't get to go behind the scenes, as it were. And I know you've thought about that kind of disjunction.
Well, it's true, because once something's built, you don't ever get to explore it in the same way. You're not a wanderer through it as a landscape. And so with the courthouse, like, I got to see the jail cells behind it, which have no windows and have no utopic dream, you know, that has the stainless steel toilet bowl, that has the lockers where the sheriffs lock their guns. So you can have this atrium and all this light flowing through and all this whiteness in the building. And then literally, as you go deeper into the depths of different floors, you know, the prisoners have separate elevators that they take up, and then they're put in the holding cells. You don't see that as a person who goes to the courthouse.
That's photographer Kathy Opie talking about her photographs of Yosemite Falls that descend through the public atrium of the new federal courthouse on First Street in downtown LA. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsia is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. And thank you very much for listening.